When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here,
reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion
or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything.
Get the right home policy at the right price
with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today, very honored to be joined by an all-time SI great, Chris Ballard. I'm sure you know his work from over the years. So many phenomenal stories by Chris in the pages of SI. And he is also the editor and compiler, overall organizer of a new book from SI and Triumph Books called The Basketball Vault. It's 40 plus pieces from over the decades from the pages of SI, covering any number of all-time great teams, individuals. It's a fantastic book. Highly encourage you to go find it. I wanted to bring Chris on not just to talk about the book, which again is phenomenal. You should go check it out. But also, this is the week, of course, that Steph Curry became SI's Sports Person of the Year. This has been a big year for him, for the Warriors in general. And Chris, Bay Area-based, has seen the rise of the Warriors and everything that preceded it. And he had a piece of his own that is in the new book, The Basketball Vault, from February of 2015, the midway point of that breakout season by Steph and the Warriors. No championships yet, no MVP trophies yet. For Steph, but the emergence of that team and the dynasty they became captured in that piece in 2015. So I thought, great time to bring on Chris to discuss the book and what went into it, but also the Warriors, past and present, where they are, where they're going. Obviously, some challenges ahead for them this season as they try to defend their title. So phenomenal conversation with Chris Ballard. Before we get to that, quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Got any feedback for me, please hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Chris Ballard is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by one of my favorite NBA writers and favorite people in the business, period, Chris Ballard. Chris, welcome.
Good to be on, Howard.
Great to see you. And the timing is fortuitous. We not only have the book that you edited, compiled, presided over, The Basketball Vault, which is 44 stories from over the years, primarily NBA, some WNBA basketball stories from the pages of SI over the decades. It's a fantastic book. Not only is that out imminently, or maybe already, but we also, this is the week of Steph Curry being named SI's Sports Person of the Year. There is not a Steph Curry piece in the book, which I'm curious about. There is a Warriors piece by you from 2015, which is well-timed in the sense that that is a nice baseline to kind of spin forward from, and we will talk about where the Warriors have been and where they are now. But let's start with this. 44 pieces, a lot of NBA legends covered, and a Warriors piece, but not a Steph Curry piece. And I know this from not having voted for Steph Curry for Finals MVP in 2015 when I voted for LeBron, that Steph Curry fans do not, they hold a grudge. They do not, nothing gets past them. Is there any particular reason why there is not at least one specific Steph Curry story in this very, very thick book, Chris Ballard, Why Do You Hate Steph, is what I'm saying.
Oh, you're trying to kill me here in the Bay Area, Howard.
You'll never be able to leave the house again.
Yeah. It was 70 years of stories. It was a lot of fun to go back and read so many of them and go through it. And so the initial list, which I compiled with the help of a lot of people, Jack McCallum and Hank Hirsch, and a lot of sort of SI veterans who knew some of the older work as well. It was like 120 stories. I mean, like the depth of stuff that Sports Illustrated has done that deserves to be in an anthology. Like you could really do like a Lee Jenkins anthology just by itself. DeFord has already had an anthology. Gary Smith has had one. So suffice to say, what ended up happening, it was like there was a Warrior story and Steph was 20% of it. And so in the end, that's how it played out. You know, we have a Giannis story. There was a lot of LeBron in there. I think partly because he's LeBron and partly because one of them is Lee writing the story announcing his return to Cleveland, which was sort of a watershed moment for both the league and also weirdly journalistically like this first person change, sort of like around the time the Players Tribune was about to start, SI became this vessel for LeBron in the same way that if you go really far back, I'm getting off topic here, Howard, I apologize, but Lou Alcindor and Bill Russell used to use Sports Illustrated this way in the 60s when they wanted to say something, especially, you know, Wilt had a story where he called the NBA a bush league. And so he came to SI and he used SI in effect as his megaphone to go after the NBA. Bill Russell would come to SI to talk about race. Lou had his things he was getting after with UCLA. And this was sort of a historical element, which you then later saw Lee pick up with LeBron.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm glad you brought that up because one of the things that I had noted as I was going through the book was, and I think it's the intro to the Frank DeFord piece with Bill Russell, where Bill Russell had sought out SI. And so it results in Frank DeFord going to Seattle and getting in a car, taking a car ride with Bill Russell down to, I think, the Bay Area to see Bill Russell's father. And the story is told that way. They're talking in the car. And I think Frank DeFord is supposed to trade off driving, but he says Bill Russell would never let him take the wheel,
yeah,
which is fantastic. Let's talk a little bit of Warriors though here. Because this is the week of Steph Curry being sports person of the year.
Sure. Sure.
Finals MVP. Finally, his fourth championship. This has been a Steph Curry's year in so many ways. I reread your 2015 piece, excellent piece, Warriors Come Out to Play, written mid-season of what would be their first championship year, when we still don't know. Like, they're dominant, but, you know, that team had just kind of started to emerge. And it's interesting to look back on that piece now and think about how far they've come, all the championships won, Kevin Durant comes and goes, Steph's just steady climb up the, you know, whatever the standings of history, whatever we're calling this, where he goes from, you know, curiosity to, you know, a two-time MVP to now a guy that I think people comfortably talk about as a top 10 all-time player. When you look back at that piece, what is it that still stands out to you about what we saw the glimmers of in 2015 that maybe hinted at this, right? Like, they were winning a lot of games. Okay, great. A lot of teams can have great regular seasons, but they don't go on to win four championships in a, whatever it's been, you know, 8-year span. What did you pick up on then that you might have thought, you know what, there might be something sustainable here, or did we even know?
Yeah. I went back and read that piece this morning, and one of the first things that popped out were all the little off-roads the Warriors could have taken but didn't, right? You know, there was a lot of pressure on ownership and Lacob at the time to stick with Mark Jackson. He had just led this team to the playoffs. It looked like they were on the rise. He was a fan favorite. The players loved him. You know, if he sticks with Mark even one more season, most likely Kerr ends up in New York with Phil Jackson. We never get Steve Kerr with the Warriors. Similarly, a couple of years earlier, you know, Budenholzer had been sort of the favorite going into the head coaching job search for the Warriors. And I remember talking to Mike about this after the fact that he came in, it would have been his first head coaching job. And he just came in gung ho. And he's like, here's my plan and here's how I'm going to do it. And it was very influenced by Greg Popovich because of his background. And then, as you know, Warriors sources later explained, basically, you know, Mark Jackson, what he does is talk on TV. Of course, he's going to win the interview. And so Mark Jackson, you know, quote, wins the interview, gets that job, has a largely positive effect on the team. But it would have been interesting to see if Budenholzer had come in, he might have started doing some of that free flowing offense with Steph almost right off the bat. It's curious. Then there's these other little vectors where it's, you know, a lot of people really thought the Warriors should trade Klay Thompson for Kevin Love for a while. And they held strong in part because Bob Myers had this this deep belief going back, which now looks incredibly prescient, that what you wanted was all these interchangeable wings who could shoot, you know, 6'6" guys with length. And so Kevin Love didn't fit that model. But at the time, Kevin Love fit every other NBA model for the most part. But now you look at it, it's like, well, yeah, Klay Thompson obviously makes sense that way. And this sort of keeps happening. And so in retrospect, it feels obvious that the Warriors became good. But I remember at the time it was, you know, Kerr was he was not necessarily embraced when he took that Warriors job. You know, a lot of fans really liked Monte Ellis. And when they traded him away, that was seen as a poor move by the organization. Right. Obviously, you know, David Lee was a fan favorite. And so starting Draymond over him and even Kerr taking the step to bench Iguodala. So obviously all these factors come into it. But, it, you know, in retrospect, a lot of it was the decision making. And so that when I wrote that story, the sports person story in 2018, what you sort of keep hearing again and again, this was here from the beginning, was that basically Lakeham was willing to spend the money and go for the best. So Lakeham was just like, you know, if it takes getting Jerry West, I want to get Jerry West. I want the best. That sort of Silicon Valley approach. Bob Myers was always thinking about, as he's put it, sort of like character. He wanted players with character. And he wanted this length. And he wanted this replicable system. So he stuck with that. And then Kerr throughout focused on personal relationships. I think that's key. But the whole thing, none of it works without Steph Curry. You know, Kerr's always said he's our Tim Duncan. And you needed that pillar, that central pillar who would set the example, who everyone could say, oh, well, you know, if Steph's going to accept fewer shots a game, then I guess I have to. So throughout this, I mean, it's remarkable. I remember talking to the other beat writers in the Bay Area early on. Like, man, it's great that we know Steph now, because it always happens. Fame changes people, you know, and we all had this sort of feeling like, oh, shoot, I hope it doesn't ruin Steph, because the guy was so pure. And it's crazy. You know him, Howard. You've done a ton of stories for the Warriors. He really is like the same person, as far as I can tell. And that said, it's so rare.
It really is. And it's funny, even the last time I wrote about him in the spring and I spent some time with him, they sat us in their film room for when I sat down with Steph for the piece that I did going into the finals about this discussion, which I think, you know, you and I should jump into a little bit too, about, you know, how difficult it's been over the years and even still now figuring out how to describe Steph, how to define Steph, how to rank Steph. Like, so we're sitting in there. And it was funny because we're in the film room, so the TV is on, and one of his commercials, like, I don't care if it was a CarMax, one of them came on, and so it was funny watching Steph react to his own commercial, but he's so self-effacing, and he's talking about how, like, he joked about how his kids are kind of, like, sick of seeing it, or think maybe they give him a little bit of grief or whatever, I can't remember the exact, but it was just, he's just so human, right? And so then we end up in a 5-minute tangent talking about the commercials and some of the things that were in improvised and things. Like fame has not, it doesn't feel like it's changed him at all. And Michael Rosenberg's great piece this week, with Steph as a sports person of the year, it's his humanity, I think, that comes through the most. And maybe that's the understated part of what has sustained them over all this time, right? Like, they go through all this tumult, Kevin Durant comes and goes, and injuries to Durant and Clay and everything else. And it's Steph's character that is kind of the constant for them, along with Steve Kerr, Bob Myers, Joe Lacob, right? That leadership group and then the consistency there. So back to Steph then. In 2015, you go out there. You don't go out there. You're out there. You live out there. You write about all those same pillars. And a lot of this is told through Steve Kerr because he's in his rookie season as coach. And it was a bold move by them. Steve had never coached. And Mark Jackson had been pretty popular in the locker room. And by the way, quick aside, one of the other what-ifs, they had pursued Stan Van Gundy, but Stan Van Gundy wanted to be both president and coach, as I recall. And if the Warriors had offered that or some dual role, I mean, maybe he's there instead of Steve Kerr, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
That he was definitely in the conversation. And he was, once again, someone who had credentials and he does great in the room. Yeah.
So it ends up being Steve. And Steve and Steph just seem to fit perfectly. And Steve and Bob Myers seem to fit perfectly. Like all these little interconnections, like the key relationships, you know, GM to coach, coach to franchise star, it all just seems to fit real well. But at that time, Steph was, I think, probably to a lot of people still like, okay, well, he's a shooter and he's small and he doesn't really guard much. At what point do you think it became apparent that, or, you know, if it even did, that this isn't just a really good player with a really good team, but this is a guy who could emerge as something more? You don't start having Mount Rushmore discussions in 2015 or even top 10 or top 20 discussions. Even a year ago, people still weren't comfortable with that. But at what point do you think it came into focus that all of these things that make Steph could amount to somebody that we now, again, comfortably talk about as an all-time great?
Yeah. That's a great question. You could probably pinpoint a lot of small moments that accrete over time, right? But one thing I think that stuck out was when Steph not only recruited Durant, but when Durant arrived, I mean, that's a key moment where you have this alpha coming in, and, you know, who can imagine what that's like? You know, you are the Bay Area's hero. You are the big dog. You're Steph Curry. You are the Warriors. And here comes Kevin Durant. And Steph, it was a month there where it was a little rocky as far as how they would coexist. And Steph, really, I think he sat back and looked big picture, which was that in the end, you know, sacrificing part of my game now to make this work and make Durant feel welcome is going to have a positive net long-term effect. That's so hard for someone. It's easier for someone to do late in their career. You know, we see players in their mid-30s doing that. Steph was in his elite prime, and to take a step back. And then for Durant to get a lion's share of the credit, and Steph never got mad, never got bitter, never said anything publicly, right? That, to me, gave a sense that, okay, in the end, we're going to look back at Steph as all those things you just mentioned, like great shooter, you know, one of the more creative players ever, changed the game offensively. But his effect on the players around him, which is how we often judge players ultimately, right? I mean, you know, James Harden may put up amazing numbers, but is anyone going to say, well, James Harden had a net positive effect on the players around him or elevated? I mean, Steph Curry has elevated. You look at all the players who've been on the Warriors, like, you know, the JaVale McGee's, the most Bates, these guys who had like brief little moments, you know, partly because of Steph. So he kept elevating people. And I don't know if we elevated Kevin Durant. All right. Kevin Durant was already pretty damn good. But at the same time that he coexisted with him so effortlessly. And, you know, we've seen Durant since then. It's hard. It's hard for someone else to play alongside him, to have the self-confidence, which I think is a huge part. Rosenberg hit on this. You know, Steph's self-confidence is innate, and it allows him in all these moments, I think, to go on. So, I think I should mention about it is, you know this, Howard, it is really hard to be assigned a Steph Curry story. And part of that is because there is no narrative. Like, if you're looking for, as a narrative writer, you're looking for conflict, you're looking for tension, and you're looking for the arc of someone's life to head one, you know, sort of to go up and down and pitfalls, and then for that person to change, you know, the hero's journey, characters change, right? And you look at LeBron, Kevin Garnett, all these fascinating guys who've changed over the years. Steph's like, he's the same guy. And there was, you know, early on, Davidson, maybe he was doubted, and then, you know, ankle injuries with the Warriors. But for the most part, he's just been really good and really boringly good, where it's fun to watch him as a fan. And, you know, even in his interviews, he's a really thoughtful, kind, gracious human being who's not going to say a lot that's he's not Draymond Green, right? So Rosenberg did a great job. That's a hard assignment to do.
Yeah. No, I was glad they assigned it to Michael and instead of me because it's tough. No, and listen, like I think the angle I took in the spring was the one that I felt like still had some, you know, you talk about we need conflict. We need the one thing Steph had to still kind of war against or whatever is still carry all this time is still being undersold, right? He was undersold coming out of high school and he's undersold coming out of Davidson. And I wasn't necessarily trying to channel that. I was more, I think, just trying to channel the idea that we, the world, still, and this is, I think the finals may have changed this, and his finals MVP and his fourth championship and one post-Durant championship, all this may have changed it. But at that time that I'm writing that piece, that was about the idea that, you know, I like to throw around the word dominant. Is Steph dominant? And nobody wants to use that word with him. And that's the word we normally use, whether it's a giant of the game like Shaq or Wilt or Kareem, or a smaller relative to NBA, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, dominant. Oh, they're dominant. And so it's this manhood, this macho-ness. This, you got to crush people. You got to dunk on them. You got to jump over them. Steph doesn't dunk on people, and he doesn't really hardly dunk at all, and he doesn't. And so that was the one that I thought was kind of interesting. And now that I've done that, I don't know what else to write about Steph. But so let me ask you this then. Should we call him dominant? Is he, do you, I don't know how you feel about the all-time rankings. I'm terrible with them anyway myself, and I don't go down that path too often. But did this past season and this championship change where he now lands in the, you know, the NBA, you know, pantheon?
Boy, I probably am biased in that. I already put Steph up there. I feel like his effect on the game, and you start to look at, you know, what, how much did a player change the game itself? And you know, Wilt changed the game. They actually, you know, widened the key for Wilt Chamberlain. You know, they were, when someone affects the game the way Michael Jordan did, and you know, the way Shaq did, you know, Steph's in that conversation of what, I don't know, 6 to 7 players ever who have fundamentally altered how people play the game. And like you're just saying, and when I grew up, everyone wanted to be, you know, I grew up in the '80s. Everyone wanted to be like Jordan or maybe Magic or maybe Larry Bird. You know, there were those elements of who you aspired to be and then who people played like, and then it'd be, you know, a little bit of Iverson after that, a little bit of Kobe. But now if you go to any youth basketball league, all the kids are trying to be like Steph. You know, they all want to shoot those step back floaters, 1 foot runners, all that, like profound impact that we're probably going to see happen, play out over the next 10 years, really. Cause all these kids who've grown up watching Steph are just now hitting an age where we're going to start seeing him in college and things like, I mean, Trae Young is probably, you know, in some ways a direct product of the success of Steph. So yeah, I mean, I'm terrible with rankings as well. You know, how do you factor defense into it? How do you factor errors, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I mean, he's certainly, how many unique players are there? He's one of them. There's a handful of unique players ever. So
something remarkable that a unexpected, right? I'm writing this past week about the just kind of weird moment of parity the NBA is experiencing right now. And statistically, the league says that, yes, in fact, when we hit the quarter mark, this is as much parity as we've ever had this deep into the season. And when I was surveying GMs about, like, well, why is this? Is this just happenstance or is this a thing? If this is a thing, what is this thing? Why is this happening? And a couple different people had said the skill level of players has never been higher. And part of it is that you can get deeper in the draft and still get a really, oh, okay, all right, well, that's interesting. But it was where this one GM took it next, where he said, and I think it's because of Steph. Like, I was not looking for a Steph thread in this story at all, but it just kind of came organically, where he said the skill level is higher in part because we already do have the first or second wave of players coming in who, having grown up on Steph, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to shoot. They wanted to handle. They worked on skills to pattern themselves after Steph. And, you know, you and I came up around the same time. So we saw when everybody was trying to be like Mike, which was not just a slogan for commercials, but a real thing. It's at the NBA level, it was athleticism, slashing, dunking, jumping over people, whatever. I think there was where people now fret over like, oh, everybody wants to shoot 30 footers. That back then it was everybody just wants to dunk on guys. They don't want to work on their footwork or what. You know what I mean? Like there's always been
something
for us to like get cranky about. But yeah, I thought like I don't know how to prove that. But if the skill level of the NBA is getting higher because of Steph, like how about that for a legacy?
That's fascinating.
Right?
Well, there's your next Steph story. Right.
I guess
there.
So. Nobody else write that before I get a chance. I'm not sure how I'm gonna prove it. I don't know where the data is for that. But it's interesting.
The story I just finished reporting is about the demise of post play. And I think those two things are linked.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that you look at is there are very few traditional sort of back to the basket centers, plotting centers who can still exist in today's league. I mean, Steven Adams is, you know, anomalous, I would say, at this point. There's a handful of them. And part of that is linked to the same thing of it is now expected that every big can shoot. You know, for a while it was like, oh, wow, Dirk can shoot. You know, it's like it was cool when big guys could shoot well. Now it's just expected. That's become part of the legacy of this is that shooting has been valued so highly that it has become the primary skill. Whereas for a while, you know, you could be really good in one thing in the NBA. There was an era when it's like, oh, that player is, you know, Matt Bullard. He is really good at shooting spot up threes. He doesn't really need to do anything else. Or you could be like an Anthony Mason, and now there's not many specialists. Everyone needs to be able to shoot.
Yes. I have often thought over the last several years, and like, I don't know if there's an objective answer here, but like, so Charles Oakley, there's a piece in the book, in the Basketball Vault, about Charles Oakley. One of the handful of stories, along with your piece on Brian Williams, Bison Dele, that are not about all-timer, you know, like Hall of Fame types, right? That there's a couple of just characters here, and Oakley is one of them. Could Oak play in today's NBA? Like, I know that sounds like heresy, but Oak was this classic old school 90s version of the power forward who, you know, banged, rebounded, defended, knocked guys on their ass. And you know, a few other things, but like you weren't counting on him to, you know, stretch the defense, space the floor. I don't think he was going to be a small ball five. I even think about like role guys I've known over the years, like, you know, Malik Rose, who was one of my favorites that I got to cover for a couple of years in New York. Obviously, Malik won championships with the Spurs. Malik just really great at his role and did play some small ball five. Had to go bang on Shaq for a while when they needed fouls to spend. I don't know. Like, do those guys exist in today's NBA? Or maybe it's if they've come up in this era, they've worked a lot on their three-point shot to be able to be out on the floor. I don't know. Can Oak play in 2022?
Like Chuck Hayes, right? He was another guy like that. I love watching Chuck Hayes play. You know, maybe like they're PJ Tucker now, right? So, I mean, PJ, if he's open in the corner, I don't think Oak had the agility to defend. He was a different type of defender. But, yeah, I mean, that's – That there's a certain, like Greg Monroe's an example of a player who, had he come along 10 years earlier, Greg Monroe would still be playing in the NBA, I think. And he probably would be, you know, maybe not all-star, but he'd be a very effective player. I saw he just signed, I think, maybe China with a team. So he couldn't defend the switch on a pick and roll. And he's not an adept three-point shooter. So unless you're going to play someone in drop coverage like Brook Lopez now, you know, which is the effective way to use a really big guy, Brook also needs to be able to shoot three-pointers or in a pinch, put him back in the post. But yeah, I mean, who's to say they wouldn't have evolved? Who's to say Oakley wouldn't have evolved? I don't know. It probably depends on the player. You know, I was recently talking to both Van Gundys about how people would translate and this idea of like, how would Shaq translate? It's a fascinating concept because, you know, as Jeff told me, he's like, he's the greatest distorter of defenses we've ever seen. And who's going to cover Shaq? Are you going to put like Jared Vanderbilt on Shaq in the post, right? But at the same time, you know, he wasn't good at shooting free throws. Maybe young Shaq is getting out on a pick and roll switch, but he's going to run into some problems there. It would be a really fascinating experiment to see the modern NBA and some of these guys in it.
Shaq wasn't that great at dealing with the pick and roll even back during his own time, and there was a lot less of it back then. But I remember that was a problem even then of getting him to come out and guard away from the paint. Yeah, and so people should keep an eye out for that. We don't want to give away too much, but yes, Chris has a phenomenal story. I'm going to assume phenomenal because all of them are. There's a reason I created hashtag always read Ballard to embarrass you for a minute. That'll be coming sometime, I believe, in January, but I can't wait to read that one. So back to one last little Warriors thread here, or maybe I have a couple. We always say this is a copycat league, right? Copycat league. People want to do it this way. You know, the Spurs win this way. People want to do it like Spurs. You know, the Suns popularized, repopularized up-tempo basketball and three-point shooting, and they're part of this era that we're in now. If this is such a copycat league, why haven't teams tried to emulate the Warriors more during this time when they are really the only living dynasty? And it's specifically this. And I understand Steph Curry is unique. He is different, as you and I have discussed, and as Michael Rosenberg wrote about again this week for SI. He's different. But we are in an era of what has been termed heliocentrism, this hyperball dominance, guys with usage rates that Michael Jordan never put up in a regular season. So James Harden, Russell Westbrook, while he was still in his prime, Luka right now. And Steph, who Mark Jackson basically just said, here, take the ball, do it, run a bunch of pick and rolls, and we'll do if Mark Jackson had stayed, maybe Steph is the key figure in heliocentrism, where it's just give it to your best player over and over and over again. But the Warriors went with this hybrid of a little bit of Spurs, a little bit of Phil Jackson's triangle, but it was ball and player movement. And meanwhile, we see teams still trying to just put the ball in one guy's hands and wring absolutely every last ounce they can get out of it. And we keep seeing the limits of that. We saw the limits of that with Harden and Houston. We're seeing the limits of that with Luka and Dallas. You can say, well, hey, smart guy, easy for you to say, these teams don't have a Klay Thompson and a Draymond Green. Like, I get that part of it. But just stylistically, not only what is more fun to watch and more enjoyable, and I think more enjoyable for the teammates of these stars, but I think probably more effective. Why? You have any theory on why teams have not tried to at least emulate what the Warriors established with the more ball and player movement friendly offense where, you know, Steph gives up the ball and then he gets it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you were talking on here about, you know, we're maybe in the era of ensemble basketball, which I think is a great way to put it. You know, I think the Jazz are a wonderful example of that, at least at the moment. If you listen to this podcast in 3 months, who knows if that holds up and who stays on that team. But maybe that's the Warriors, like maybe that's how other teams are trying to be like them is, yeah, you can't find another Steph, but it's all about who the complementary role players are. And the Warriors have done, well, mostly a really good job. That I think probably their issues this season partly come down to not having a bench that necessarily fits with the first five, right? They're trying to, you were by this, trying to simultaneously rebuild and then win again this year. But maybe that's the legacy of the Warriors is maybe GMs and coaches look more for, you know, maybe that's why PJ Tucker gets a lot of money. They're really looking for who are the role players are being valued more. Whereas, you know, like a Russell Westbrook, there's nothing really on the trade market for him, in part because he doesn't fit with anyone. Right. Who are you getting? What's the optimal lineup where you Russell Westbrook is your best or second best player? I don't think there is one anymore. Yeah. And even when he was, it was that's a really hard, like you got to work some jujitsu to figure out a team. Whereas, you know, a guy like Draymond Green, especially in his prime, you put him on any team and he's going to make that team better. And Steph Curry is not a star who needs you to fit certain types of players around him. Obviously, you want shooters around Steph. But I bet you Steph could adapt to most lineups pretty effectively as well. So, yeah, I mean, that'd be my best take at it. What's yours?
I To me, it's a couple different things. If I have any working theory, it's that the other guys who are really great with the ball in their hands a lot, right? So you have to have a guy who is great as both a creator, shot maker, you know, all of that, right? So if you have one of those all-in-one guys, a James Harden, a Russell Westbrook when he was still in his prime, a Luka now, maybe a Trae Young you could put in this conversation, you're now a little beholden to their makeup, their personality. And if the makeup, and if the personality you're beholden to, the star you're beholden to as a franchise, because franchises have to cater to their stars. If it's Steph, you got no worries. You got no problems. Steph, we're going to come up with an offense where you give up the ball a lot, but you're still going to get it back a lot. And even if you don't get it back, don't worry about it. This is how we're going to win more games. Your usage is going to be 10 percentage points below James Harden's, but we're going to win more. If you've got Steph, that's fine. If you have James Harden, I think the track record suggests that you just can't do that. James Harden wants to play the way James Harden plays. And that's not even unique to this era. Like, I thought about this even in when Iverson was at his best, and the Sixers could never get guys who were great offensive players to fit with him because they were so Iverson centric. And I think Marbury fits in this a little bit. I think Steve Francis fit in this a little bit. So we've had different versions of it. We just now have a league where, because of analytics, there's become more of a belief that there's not too much of a great thing, right? If those guys who I just named, Iverson, Steve Francis, Marbury, were playing in this era, their usage rates would be like 35, because some GM or coach or their analytics department would probably say our best bet is just keep going with that guy.
Yep.
And I think a lot of it is, or at least part of it is the character and the ego of the player. And maybe it's just that the Warriors, you know, found something magical in the combination of guys that they got in their holy trinity of Curry and Clay and Draymond. And maybe it's just really hard to replicate that aspect. I don't know. I just know that that's the basketball I love watching the most. And I think it's also the most effective. And maybe it's also a little bit of, you know, like my personal bias is I spent 5 years, you know, listening to Phil Jackson speak every day when I was covering the Lakers, and then a few years listening to Mike D'Antoni speak every day when I was covering the Knicks. And those two guys, while very, very different and don't really like each other, they both believe in the same basic premise, and their offenses are very different, right? But they both believe in the same basic premise. Mike D'Antoni calls it, you know, the ball finds energy. Phil Jackson was all about the triangle, which was, you know, everybody needs to touch the ball, feel part of it. And that's just kind of the way I believe in basketball, right? Like, I know there's one guy out there sometimes who is absolutely supremely better than everybody else, but it's still a five-man game, a five-person game. And I think you have to honor that. And I think that's the way that guys still feel involved and energized and effective and in rhythm in the fourth quarter when you might need them to make an open shot when you get triple teamed. I don't know. That's my thought.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, going back and reading that story about the Warriors from 2015, that Kerr already valued then, which has been a hallmark of his coaching, is trying to get minutes for the 11th and 12th players on a team. Yeah. I think the way he put it is like, you know, if they don't feel bought in, that can get to be insidious, right? So it starts from the bottom and then works its way up through your roster. And I recall talking to Steve at the time, and he was just kicking himself for not getting Brandon Rush into this early season game when there was a window of opportunity. But I think it's because he understood this, is to have a player like Steph who's going to get all the attention and score 30 a game or whatever it is, you know, you need to empower those other players. So even, you know, what we saw last night, the Warriors, we're taping this on Thursday, the Warriors lost a crazy game to the Utah Jazz. And at the end, they had a four-point lead. But they were playing essentially their second team with Klay Thompson. You know, there have been some injuries. Andrew Wiggins is hurt. And Steve decided to give some players the night off, play the long game. But at the same time, you know, Ty Jerome starts for the Warriors. You know, here's a sort of marginal NBA point guard who's starting for the defending champion Warriors. And I'm sure, you know, Kerr, he does this stuff intentionally. It's not just, I want to rest my starters. It's to get buy-in from these other players, to get Kuminga his 35 minutes, because it's got to be hard being such a high pick who's so skilled and still being on the fringe of a rotation. You know, Wiseman got recalled to play 10 minutes in this game as well. So I think that's certainly a part of it. It's the Warriors' culture of making sure everyone, even if you're going to play 4 minutes, that you feel bought in somehow.
All right, so because you brought it up, and you brought up Kuminga and Wiseman, though not Moody, but we'll bring him up now too. And you did allude to the what I called the dual track plan that people have called the two timeline approach. Did the Warriors mess this up, Chris? Was this a bad, like, this was like, there's a lot of this. This is ownership is got a heavy hand in this, I think. And Bob Myers certainly too. But you know, the way that the NBA traditionally goes is if you got it, you got to run, you got a guy, you squeeze every last drop out of it. And that normally means veterans. And yes, it is highly unusual, almost unprecedented to try to do this thing where you're developing the next generation while you've still got the vestiges of a dynasty and can still win championships. Did they screw this up? Should they have traded those guys when they were still picks, when they were still rookies, when they were still it was easy to say they did the right thing in June when they were confetti's falling, or maybe there was no confetti. They were in Boston when the champagne was flowing in June. It was easy to say, you know what? Good bet. Right now, it's looking a little iffy. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those where it's the light years ahead concept of Lacob rearing its head a little bit here, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're going to do both. You know, we're going to, you know, watch us pull off this thing that's almost impossible to pull off. And it certainly feels, you know, if you had one or even two of these draft picks who you're grooming, but keeping all three of them, I remember this is my personal drum I was banging, is I thought the Warriors should have drafted Tyrese Halliburton in that draft instead of Wiseman, because Halliburton, I mean, obviously that looks even better now, but at the time it just felt like what they needed was an NBA ready player. Yeah. You want like the same thing you're talking about, and you could still, you know, maybe Halliburton, his ceiling was seen as lower at the time than Wiseman's. You know, we'll see how it all plays out. Obviously he's quite good right now, and Wiseman's struggling a bit, but I think you had to go the middle road of it. You could build, but then you have to do the middle road, or you can't just vacate all your vets from the roster, which is what happened this year.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't lose Otto Porter and Gary Bean. You know, you can't have – and then Iguodala is not even going to play. So you've lost all that institutional knowledge off the back half of your team. And then, you know, even the public signals of paying Jordan Poole. We're moving forward. So, you know, obviously this season, I'm sure they wish it had gone differently, on a lot of ways so far, but yeah, I think it was an overreach. But you know, let's say if Wiseman were dominating right now, or at least being an effective piece, it might look a lot different.
There's two things that hit me from your 2015 piece that apply to this discussion, actually. One is that Bob Myers and Steve Kerr back then talked about really enjoying having and seeking out big men who could pass, right? They traded Monte Ellis for Andrew Bogut, phenomenal passer as a center. David Lee was a great passer. Draymond Green's a great passer. They drafted Wiseman, super raw, three college games, we know the whole thing. And maybe Wiseman's in a whole different place now, if not for all the injuries. He's still, as I keep saying, he's a virtual rookie. He still hasn't even played 82 NBA games. But maybe it's also that he just doesn't fit the mold of what they valued all before. Like, did they abandon that? And in concert with that, you wrote about this in 2015, about how they loved, and you talked about this earlier in this discussion, they loved having those guys like 6'6 to 6'8 who were long and switchable and could do a lot of things. That's Tyrese Halliburton. That's even to an extent LaMelo Ball. Like, they picked Wiseman as a center who does not have the attributes that they traditionally valued in centers, and they picked him instead of some, you know, tall, long wings who were the interchangeable types that they presumably, like, did they lose track a little bit of their own values, maybe?
It was almost like they needed the number four pick, right? Because then you could go with your gut, what you really wanted. I think that was part of it. It was like this, oh, we have to take advantage of this. So
yeah,
who's the potential generational player here? Yeah. Who's like, I think that maybe the analytic element of it, you know, who's the least replaceable option among these guys? And they got a little bit, you know, the shiny thing. You know, you'd be crazy not to to take that, right? I think that was it. You know, which is why if you trade down and you know you sort of get a middle lottery pick, maybe that would have been better for them. Obviously, it's hindsight in 2020. But you're right. You know, it's like Wiseman. He was. I don't see a situation in which he becomes a particularly skilled passer for a big. You know, and the Warriors they don't really post up at all. So the majority of what they use their bigs for is screening and then becoming a pocket passer, right? So you need to make a really good decision in that 4-and-3 situation. And are you kicking to the wing? Are you going to the dunker spot? Do you attack the rim? That's where you're looking for savvy, agile players if you're drafting for that spot. You know, Looney has certainly evolved quite nicely into that role, and Draymond's the best at it. But Wiseman fits none of that. You know, I mean, he's more of a traditional rim roller. He's like a Tyson Chandler type, you know, ideally. But yeah, it was weird. It didn't fit what you would expect the Warriors to do. Maybe that's what was so surprising about it, right? I mean, you could totally see Kuminga and you can see Moody to a certain extent. You know, both those guys, Moody especially, fit with the Warriors' ethos.
Tyson Chandler's another what if, by the way. Wasn't there the one summer where the Warriors really chased Tyson Chandler hard? They chased Dwight Howard hard once. Like, there's some other things here that could have happened along the way where, you know, they went all in a particular direction. And it's just like, well, no, but Tyson Chandler decided to go to the Knicks and Dwight Howard chose the Rock. I'm remembering that correct, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, loop back, and then they sort of turned down the services of Dwight Howard a few years later because it became clear how little he fit there. Their rubric.
All right, before we go, The Basketball Vault is the book, which we alluded to at the top. I believe it. So you mentioned having well over 100 or something pieces to consider. It ended up at, I think I counted 44. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what you counted, Howard. I trust
it. My math skills are, you know, a little suspect at times. Is there a favorite among all of these? I mean, obviously all the greats are covered here. You know, Michael, Kobe, LeBron, Shaq, Kareem, Bill Russell, and, you know, obviously phenomenal writers throughout. Was there one that, you know, because it's a lot of reading for you to do to even kind of narrow it down to what's finally going to go. What was the one where you sat back and went, man, I'm really glad I got a chance to, like, go back down this particular road?
Well, some of them I chose because they were great writing, and like Gary Smith's stories, you want to get in there. But the one that pleasantly surprised me, because I'd forgotten about it and I went back and looked, was Jackie Mack wrote a story about Barkley and Jordan's friendship. And she's a remarkable reporter who has deep relationships with players, and that comes through in this story. But I didn't know a lot of this, and it was about how all throughout their career, starting prior to being drafted, Barkley and Jordan had become such good friends. And all throughout his career, Barkley talked about how, you know, MJ was there providing financial advice. You know, where there's Nike, for example, he's like, ask for less money, but stock options. You know, he became this big brother figure to Charles all throughout his career. And it just shed some light on these really wonderful moments and a type of reporting that you don't see as much today because everyone is so managed and so aware of how things play. You know, but it's like at one point, Scottie Pippen slams Charles and Charles just goes off on Scottie for a while. I mean, it's Charles, of course, but the insight into this friendship and how important it was to Charles gave me a new, sort of, I guess, a new perspective on Jordan, who I'd always seen as a little bit cold and maybe aloof with a lot of his teammates. And I knew him and Charles were friends. But Jackie does a really good job of painting this whole portrait. And then she writes a postscript to this story, which talks about the interview with Charles, which she did. And it was, he'd just blown up, I think it was his knee, and it was his career ending injury, but he had agreed to speak to Jackie at some point during the season. So he, you know, he kept his promise, and they met at a hotel, and he had his leg propped up on a pillow, and Jackie said she broke her longstanding rule about not socializing with players and had a glass of champagne with Charles to toast his career and had this retrospective. And it had this feeling of the journalist and the subject as equals, which I loved, right? I think there was a whole era of sports writing where there was this mutual trust that often developed between writers and subjects, and where it wasn't, you know, one wasn't up here and the other was down here. And Jackie, I think, embodies that. And obviously her ethics are you know, unparalleled as well. So everyone respects her. That comes through in the piece. So that would be the one that's my push for the book is, you know, stories like that by writers like that.
Yeah. Jackie's the greatest. And, you know, on that note, you note the postscript. One of the cool things about this book for folks who might be running out to buy it, and you should, is that for a lot of these pieces, the writers themselves have provided, you know, current day blurb, sometimes a paragraph, sometimes several, for the book as a postscript to say, you know, here's what I remember about reporting this story, or here's what happened after that, or here's what I then heard from the guy. So there's a lot of really cool new context, in a way, or reflection to add to the pieces that are already in there. So all great stuff. Chris, great job with this. I can't wait to read the piece on Postplay in SI, I believe in January. So people keep an eye out for that. And everybody go around and get the Basketball Vault. Chris, this has been fantastic, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks, Howard.
Appreciate you. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Chris Ballard. Thank you to our producer, Shelby Royston, and thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeBest Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly.